this sounds good.
Yeah, it sure does. There we go. All right, so Ephesians chapter 5. And, I remember now, last week, we had begun looking at this thing. And we'll go to verse 25 to get some context. Husbands, love your wives, even as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for it. And again, no woman should ever marry a man she doesn't think would give himself for her.
Amen.
That's just all there is to it. And there's a lot more than giving yourself than just willing to take a bullet. Okay, it's a lot of things. You know, I talk a lot about our old men in the church who we've watched give themselves for their wives. You know, we've watched that with Paul Gordon, Dick Botens, Skip Feister, where the point came where they could still be living kind of a normal life with the guys, hanging out, that kind of stuff. When their wives got ill, that was it. They're absolutely devoted now to that home and seeing to it that that woman was taken care of. And I love that example. I talked about last week my uncle, who doesn't profess to be godly or anything of the sort, drinks beer, cusses like a sailor, 83 years old, his wife just died, but the last couple years of his life, by golly, he saw to it that she was taken care of. And it's like he told me, he said, I couldn't even trust my kids to do it. It's not that they don't love her, but I would have never trusted them to take care of her like I took care of her. So it was interesting, too. I'd never understood their courtship before. Both of them were working at American Airlines in the ticket counter in Los Angeles, knew each other at a couple social events, talked one time, thought, and they both said, you know, we could probably get married. You know, we agree so much, and they did in a week. 57 years later, you know, it all worked. But I don't think I've ever quite heard that before. So careful of the American Airlines ticket counter.
Take a bus.
Yeah.
Sorry. I'll take a train that's slower.
Yeah. Oh, that's the line of the night. All right. All right, so the thing is, verse 26, he gave himself for it that he might sanctify and cleanse it by the washing of water by the word. You know, one of the rules of marriage is this, that the woman is the flower of the plant. And what do I mean by that? It's, if you think of them as one flesh, and for example, I knew a preacher some years ago who I was always suspicious of him because he always dressed better than his wife. Nothing disgusts me more than that. I think a preacher ought to dress right, but somehow when she was always drab and he was dressed well, I never thought well of him. No, it just disgusted me that he would do that. I thought of him as effeminate. And fundamental preacher and all that kind of stuff, but I never trusted him and such. Because God made that woman to be better looking. Now, I know some of you fellows have noticed, but they've got that hands down. And they just do. God made it that way. And I've had guys come up to me, and some of you have heard me say this before, but I cannot emphasize this enough. I've had guys, usually it's they haven't been in the church long, there's troubles in the marriage, whatever else, and they'll finally take me aside and tell me just what kind of a witch they're married to. You know, my God, she does this and that, she's this, she's doing that, I can't stand it any longer. And I'll turn them to 1 Corinthians 11, where it says the woman is the glory of the man. Now, what's the glory of a flower? The flower. You know, it's the glory of a plant. The flower on the plant's the glory of it. When we go on, we look at some roses, we don't want, boy, those are great thorns. Boy, you've really worked on those leaves there, you know. You know, guy, gal, that's a sturdy root system. You know how you can tell if the rose is healthy? There's a beautiful rose on that thing. Now, let's say the rose is bad. You know, some of you taking care of flowers. You go out there and the flowers aren't healthy or whatever else. You don't go, oh, these terrible flowers. You realize, hey, I need to get it in more sun. The roots are maybe either they're being rotted out from too much water, not getting enough water, not enough nutrition to it, something wrong with that stem. Something's going on. You might have to tie the stem against the stakes of the flower, get more. There are a lot of things you might have to do, but you never blame the flower for what it's looking like. You know that it's something else in the plant. So when a man comes up to me and says, my wife, she just runs her mouth all the time, and she's constantly nagging at me and blah, 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 and I'll stop and show them that verse. Now, buddy, you've just told me a lot about yourself. Okay? You've told me what you are, and this is how it's being shown to the public, what your wife's like. Okay? And it stops them a bit. You want your wife to become different. You need to change. We need to work on the root. We need to work on the plant. We need to work on what she's growing on. She cannot thrive on a bad plant. She cannot do it. Okay? So, and it takes them back a little bit. You know, buddy, you say your wife's a witch. You know, and well, then your glory, how God wants people to see your glory is a witch. That's how God wants people to see what you are. Now, women liver might get mad at that, but that's what my Bible says, and I found it to be true over and over. If you find a woman who, you know, everyone's always saying, well, I always think of Miss Randall. She's in her 70s now, and Tim McVeigh was just preaching there in Lexington where she was at, and he said still just looks 10 years younger. Absolutely a ladies' lady, always the proper things to say, so pleasant and everything else. What that does is tell you a lot what her husband was like. She had that atmosphere. She had that. And he's dead now, but she'll never lose that. And you can see a lot. You know, you look at Miss Hain, for example. Miss Hain is another person like that. Ever so much the lady, polite in what she says, wise in what she says, thoughtful in what she says. What's that a reflection of? That's a reflection of what she's growing on, the vine she's on. It's a reflection of that. So the thing is, a husband is to love his wife as Christ loved the church. Why? That he might nurture it and care for it and sanctify it with a washing of water by the word. And a man has that concern for his wife all the time with him privately, and she'll look good publicly. I mean, not all the time. There's always going to be goofy stuff that goes on or something else. But it makes a difference with her countenance, who she's married to, and it just does. And so this is one of those passages that talk about it. And it says in verse 27 that he might present it to himself, a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle, or any such that. Men, buy your wife's oil of old age. No spot or wrinkle. All right? Oil of old age, you know. All right. All right. So that he might present it unto himself, a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle, or any such thing, that it should be holy and without blemish. You know, it's interesting because when you read the story of Esther and she's being made ready to go into the king, mm-hmm. Do you realize that she spent a long time laying in beds of oil? Beds of fragrance. Well, for one thing, I'm not trying to pick on the Amish, but obviously they're not hyper about deodorant like we are. Okay? They're not. Okay? My great uncle, who grew up in Bain Inlet, Ontario, way back in the very turn of the 1900s, and grew up then. And they used to talk about how in the springtime they'd wait for the first boat to come down the river. It'd be the first one, and the horn would go. You couldn't keep kids in school when the first boat came, and you know it'd come and there'd be bananas and fruit, and only the richest people could even afford that stuff. But it would all be on there, and they'd run. There'd be no wares for the stores and everything. But he also, we were watching Gunsmoke, and there was a dance going on. He said, boy, that place stinks. What do you mean by that, Uncle Mike? And he said, I used to go to dances like that. And those girls would pull out those gowns, same gown their mother wore, same gown their grandmother wore. Nobody could wash that gown. They just poured more perfume and more perfume on it. And he said, you'd go in there and be this horrible stench of body odor and perfume. And that's just what it was. So imagine a woman who's been on camels all her life. Now, to give you an idea, when I was over in Greece in the 70s, friends of mine that were stationed in Turkey said, when you got Turkish money, you did not put it in your pocket. It stunk so bad. Because Turks would go ahead and they'd stick that money in some private place on their body. and have it there sometimes for years, never take baths, and hello there, Mr. Peter, and but never take baths, anything of that sort. And when they brought the money out, they said, Turkish money, just...
Yes. You can have his inhaler.
Wow. Mother will get his inhaler.
I can give him a bed for about one.
Thank you. You're welcome. Right.
So the thing is, the money stunk to high heaven, is what they're saying there. Well, imagine a woman who's lived with Bedouins all her life. For example, it's estimated that Queen Elizabeth, the first Queen Elizabeth, might have taken one or two baths in her entire life. Okay? Because back in those days, they thought that water was dangerous for you. They thought it hurt you. And people just didn't bathe. And so you just imagine what that court smelled like and everything else. And so, people were just used to it. That just wasn't anything to them. So imagine a king who's living in a palace, and you fragrance, myrrh, aloe, all these kind of thing, frankincense.
If you're saying that about clothes, but the place, and I know the Jews were known for, you know, their sanitation for cleaning and running water and all that. So why would the king be caught up in the cleanliness if that wasn't part
Well, keep in mind, we're talking about Queen Elizabeth of England, not the Jews.
Well, yeah, but Esther...
But now we're dealing with Esther, and she's about to go in before a king. Now, she's Jewish. She's not unclean.
Right.
But the king is sleeping with a different virgin every night for a couple of years. So how many do you think that is? About 700-some. It might have gone on longer than that. So the thing is, how many of those virgins do you think came from families with Esther's cleaning standards? Very few.
But were they afraid of water and all that the way?
Probably not.
No.
But they live in a more desert climate. Hmm. They're just not used to that kind of thing as far as bathing and all that kind of thing. Go put your left finger on an Arab that's newly come into the United States. He'll want to kill you. You know why? They clean their butts with their left finger. That's why if you ever look at people that have come from Europe and Asia and that kind of thing, they'll have a longer fingernail on their left little finger. And you do not touch that. They don't like anybody that'll touch them with that finger. That's as bad an insult as you could imagine. Okay? But just imagine living in a country where we don't have paper and all that kind of stuff. And, what do you do? And it's one of the first things you learn is cleanliness and how to keep yourself clean. So you live in these cultures... You know, how do you handle that? What do you do with that kind of stuff? So the thing is, you've got...
With your pinky out?
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Drinking tea with your pinky up. Right? But that wasn't their point doing it. But again, the point in this is... With the king, he'd lay this woman, and she would be in this immersed for a long time, in this plant, immersed for a long time, in this plant, everything else. Also changing what they ate, okay? Changes how you smell, okay? You know, go spend a week eating nothing but kielbasa and beans, and, it's going to change, you know. It's, the most delicate of us won't be delicate when it's all said and done. So... I always go back and I tease my ladies with this, but down south the fellows used to talk about eating possum. And the thing is, possum is one of the most horrible bottom feeders in the forest that there is. They'll eat anything. And they, no, you have to keep them in a cage, they'd say, and feed them corn for about 6 weeks. And they said, and they used to do that with rats. They'd catch a rat and feed it good food for about 6 weeks and eat it. The old black people would. But the thing is, they said once you took that possum and you fed it corn for about 6 weeks or so, they said it was good meat. Really tasted good. They liked it because it's not eating just garbage and horrible things off the forest floor anymore. Well, I used to kid my girls. I think, Debbie, you remember that one? Kate, I don't know if you remember me using that illustration. I told the girls when they came in, I said, we got to feed you sweet corn for a while so guys will want you. You know, you've been out there in the world.
I remember now.
Yeah, now she remembers. Even the blonde gets it. All right.
Oh. But,
write it down for Sharon. She'll get it tomorrow. All right. But the whole thing is... Esther comes in here, even though she may have been clean, she's in a regimen. Because when that queen got that woman's bed, he don't want to smell her camel. He don't want to smell all the horrible things she's been eating and such. He wants her to absolutely smell good. So they put them through long periods of time in the harem before they could even come to the king. That's why Sarah was so long in the harem, and the king hasn't slept with her yet. She hasn't gone through the purification. Not until her breath is different, every smell on her is different, everything else is different. She's been soaked in this stuff. So the thing is, when it says Jesus Christ loved the church to make it so it's without spot or wrinkle. Now you can imagine some woman coming in, she's been out in the sun, all this kind of stuff, and suddenly she's had eunuchs caring for her, bathing her, soaking her in oils and lavenders and all these things and such. Not a spot or wrinkle in her when it's done. When she comes into the king, just absolutely it looks like an Ivory Snow commercial. So Jesus Christ does that with the church. Brings it in, purifies it, cleanses it, so it's without spot or wrinkle to him. Okay? All right. So verse 27 again, that he might present it to himself a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, that it should be holy and without blemish. Now look at verse 28. So ought men to love their wives as their own bodies. He that loveth his wife loveth himself. A man that can't love his wife doesn't even really love himself. And it's all part of marriage in this sense. A traditional marriage, not everybody has one, but a traditional marriage, daddy goes off to work, mama's stuck home with little brats, taking care of them and such. And he expects when he comes home to, have the food cooking and things taken care of or whatever else. But what's he providing? He's providing a home. He's providing a place. He's providing somewhere where every woman really craves. Having a home where her children and somebody's taking care of them. Somebody's paying these bills. And you have nice little things to put on those kids and clothes to cook for them. And you have all these kind of things. And you know what? Every woman loves to be able to gussy up in the mirror and do that kind of thing. And a husband, it's his honor to give him those kind of things. And it's a wonderful thing. When men have a lot of money, they go out and buy their wife some kind of a car. When they don't, get her a candy bar. You know, you come home and I've had times, that's gone over just as big as anything else. A little peppermint patty. And it just, what's it mean? It just means I'm out somewhere and I love you to death and was thinking of you. And we only had a buck left, but I spent 75 cents of it on this. But that's that traditional role. That's how Jesus Christ loved the church, to give of what he had for her and such. And a man's to think that way of his own wife. And it used to be a covenant back and forth. One of the reasons that women don't want a traditional marriage anymore is they can't find a traditional man. They can't find a man who has that kind of attitude towards her. She'll do all that stuff. He comes home, turns the television on, watching, doesn't give a rip or whatever else. And, she wants to be romantic and, he's letting wind and I'm tired. That's the average reality. The sad part is, one of the things I've learned after pastoring for a while, when a couple loses their honeymoon flavor, it's almost always the man that loses it first. Almost always. Somehow or other, he just doesn't have that same zeal for it. And disappoints her. Disappoints her. She's kind of looking like, what happened? What's wrong with me? Or whatever else. And that's a work that has to be kept up. It's all part of life. That idea, we got a couple of young people in here or whatever else, and right now they can't even imagine that one day that they might get old and not feel romantic. But the day will come when you don't feel romantic anymore. It's something you have to work at and keep laboring at. All right. Now it says this, verse 29, for no man ever yet hated his own flesh. Okay, no matter what a psychiatrist tries to tell you, it's never happened that a man hated his own flesh. But nourish it and cherishes it, even as the Lord the church. And if you watch, men are pretty big about taking care of their flesh. They're pretty big about it. And you know, the fathers going to the mirror and watching all this kind of stuff. But a man that has the right attitude looks at his wife as his own flesh. And that's what he's going to take care of first. He's going to see to it that she's fed, she's taken care of, she has good clothes, she has these kind of things. And he will always be second fiddle to that. Always. It's put that forward for her, see to it she has it. And to be honest with you, you men have done it. It's kind of fun. You know, kind of fun seeing him come in and, you know, thrilled with this new thing or whatever else it is and showing you. And, you know, I'm always trying to pretend to my wife, I see the difference. Oh, I, and, you know, it drives her nuts because she could dye her hair orange and I wouldn't notice for a week. Somebody'd ask me.
Now, if I your hair, you would.
Yes. I can get out of the truck on this side of the road if she's in a bad mood. I know it. There's electricity in the air. You know? But, I mean, she could be dressed in black, hair orange, and pierce her cheek, and I wouldn't notice it for a week. Yeah.
That's debatable.
Yeah. It is amazing what I don't see. No, you just cannot imagine. Yes. You cannot imagine.
It's down the road.
Yeah, yes. I've had people say, but I was honking at you, and Mr. Magoo's just driving on.
People doing this outside the van. Yeah.
Can you tell it's happened a couple times?
I don't see. For no man ever yet hated his own flesh, but nourish it and cherish it, even as the Lord of the church. One of the most exciting things that young couples have found coming to this church is restoring this kind of stuff. Doesn't mean it's perfect. Doesn't mean it's everything it's supposed to be. But the things you have gotten right, hasn't it been fun getting that stuff right? It really has. It's been fun getting that stuff right. And there's tears sometimes and things that don't work right and places where you wish it had and places you feel guilty, but boy, by golly, the stuff you do get right is so wonderful. And it's, to me, one of the greatest pleasures of being a pastor is watching that stuff get right in families and just seeing that natural love spring and affection. And really, there is nothing better for children than to see that kind of love affair go on between parents. There's just nothing better than for them to see that. Then it says this, verse 30, for we are members of his body, of his flesh, and of his bones. Now this is something here. When a person gets saved, Jesus Christ, of course, has a body. He rose again in a body. He's in heaven in a body. If you get saved, you become part of that body. Not some spiritual body out there somewhere, but literally his body. You can walk up, sound the flesh, somebody slaps the flesh. That body, you become part of it. Okay? You become part of that. It's a spiritual body in the sense it's resurrected, but it's a flesh body in the sense it can eat, can talk, sit down, occupy space. It's a real body raised again. You become part of that. Okay? And just like a man and a wife, and it's about to say that here. Verse 31, for this cause shall a man leave his father and his mother and shall be joined unto his wife, and they two shall be one flesh. Now, for a long time, people thought that was just kind of allegoric, the idea that they're one flesh, you know, in one house or whatever else. But we've learned scientifically now there's a lot more to that, the idea that they're one flesh. Now, part of the thing that makes it hard for people in this room is the majority of the people, at least 60 and under, okay, at least 60 and under, grew up in the heydays and probably even 65 and under to you know, to pull in the Vadises or whatever. But, for example, when I was in, I talk about this thing, when I was in grade school, you know, we were under an old-fashioned kind of edict in school, that kind of thing. By the time I got to the 7th or 8th grade, that was gone, you know. I remember a girl one time coming in and wearing a knit sweater with huge big holes in it, and that's all she had on, leaning over the English teacher's desk, and he asked her, are you afraid of catching cold? And, you know, what else can you say? You know, there's some 16-year-old nubile girl, you know, and she's only wearing a knit, you know, some, you know, fishnet-type top or something like that, and everybody's trying to wonder how to cope with these things and the changes and all that kind of stuff going on, and these are the same classes that 5 or 6 years ago, every girl wearing a dress and, you know, and everything indecent. And it all broke down. And so, you know, by the time I went my first year of college, you know, any girl that was a virgin was kind of like out of it or whatever. And I think she'd even lie to say she wasn't, you know, and such. And, you know, for guys, a terrible pressure of still being a virgin and such. And, you know, they made wacko movies, Porky's and everything, all about the pressures and all that kind of stuff that was on, you know, people at that time. So all that stuff was going on. And what people didn't realize is the horrible depressions that came over people from that lifestyle. I mean, just awful, bitter depression. And nobody understood it because they didn't understand the Bible in the sense that when a virgin girl and a virgin guy come together and sleep together, more happened than just fluids. A lot more happened. Things happened in their minds. And real changes. We're talking about things that can be measured by machine. We're talking about, first of all, dopamine, which is, for example, when a person gets addicted to cocaine, for example, dopamine is the problem. When you give someone cocaine, there's a dopamine rush in them. And a dopamine rush is something that you like. It's something God put in there to make you want something more of it. Well, cocaine artificially brings dopamine to the surface. So what happens now is they can't get that dopamine rush again without that cocaine. And so they're taking that cocaine to get that dopamine rush, but now it's giving them less and less of it each time they do it. So it's taking more and more because it's artificially making that dopamine come to the forefront. So one of the things that happens, let's say a girl for the first time, she's being intimate with a boy, and it doesn't even have to be all the way, as they used to say, but she's just being intimate, where suddenly every one of her senses is opened up and everything's moving inside of her and such. Well, one of the things that happens, there's a dopamine release in her, such as has never happened to her before. What happens with that dopamine release? The boy in front of her becomes tattooed inside of her. What does the back of his ear smell like? That subtle, musky smell. It's tattooed in her. What are his eyes like when he's half awake? What's he like when he's smiling? What are the corners of his mouth look like? What's his sweat smell like? What's all of that smell like? What's he look like? All of that becomes photographed and tattooed into her brain, and it literally becomes as much part of her as herself. Those very things. Now, God had meant that so that this young man, because most of the time in the Bible, girls are 15, 16, maybe even 14 years old when they're being taken. And so there they go, and off they go. And she has this affection and love for this man as deep as her affection and love for herself. It happened to her physiologically. So the thing is, God said, now they're one flesh. The man had the same thing go on. Dopamine's released in him. But what happens with that dopamine now is it's gone even further. It's given him a sense of protection like a bull in a field has for the cows in that field. You know, if you go out there in a field and there's a bunch of heifers, that bull's going to act different than if he's by himself. He's got this sense, this feel. So it gives this guy this sense, and what he wants to do now is protect her. He wants to take care of her. He wants to see to it that nothing hurts her. And this is the natural thing that's released in him in the dopamine. And they can actually measure those chemicals now with MRIs and such, and they can see it happen. They'll photograph the brain and see those differences and such that are in there. So now imagine what that's like. Here's, you know, 15-year-old Sally Sue and 16-year-old Billy Joe, and they've just become intimate. So here's Sally Sue. Here's Billy Joe, who could not go out and earn a living. He has no idea how to even take care of himself. No way he can take care of a baby. There's no way he can take care of her. And yet, suddenly, he has this sense of protection has become part of him. As much as if you went up and tried to hit him in the privates, you know, he's going to do everything he can to protect himself. That same feeling has come over him for that woman. But what's the woman taught? Don't let God control you. Go do what you want to do and this kind of stuff. So what it does is it breaks him emotionally and mentally. It just destroys him. It just absolutely turns him into jelly. And so he's standing there, and here's this girl that he feels, and now she's off flirting with the captain of the football team. Because she's free. You know, nobody's going to control me. But this girl that's a virgin has just gone through this. She is in love with that boy in ways she never even knew she could have. And the average guy that gets a girl like that, he's already had 3-4, so he goes off and he's with Sally Sue now somewhere. And she goes through a reaction that is as bitter and awful as divorce. And she's only 15 years old. And there's no one to help her through that except other 15-year-old girls. She can run to the school nurse, who'll give her a condom. But, you know, anybody here ever had a friend go through divorce? Would a condom help her? Does it make her feel better? Doesn't do a thing for her, okay? She's just standing there. She's just completely destroyed, miserable, hurt inside, wretched, and depression, suicidal. She has lost something that is part of her flesh. And the problem is nobody teaches that in the public schools. I gave some books on that to Mary Botens. She came back to me almost a year later, had passed them through teachers all over school, and Mary just said, how do we tell this to the kids? How do we even make them see this so they understand the damage they're doing to themselves? So the average young girl, by the time she's gone through her third or fourth boy, that part of her doesn't work anymore. Doesn't work. She goes ahead and she sleeps with the guy, and none of the dopamine's not released, and she doesn't. That bonding doesn't happen. It's all broken inside of her. Now, here's what the sad part is: that bonding is the same bonding she bonds with her children, because the next time the dopamine's released in her is when a baby's in the birth canal. That's why, you know, you women, remember when that baby was born, how much difference you... It was just stunning. No matter how bad you hurt, that baby was born and you just loved that baby perfectly. It's the most wonderful thing in the world and such. And God put that in there. Now think of why he would do that. Because you have a woman to love that man, to love that baby. The next time is when the baby's on the breast and she's lactating. When that's going on, that same thing's happening to her again. So you just think of it from God's standpoint of what he's built into her. Meanwhile, there's some guy who will kill anybody that walks through that front door. He's going to protect that baby. He's going to protect that woman. All that's going to go on. Well, by the time they get out of junior high now, all that's destroyed them. By the time they get out of junior high, that's already been ruined and hurt. Now, can that be healed? Yes, that can. You better believe it can. My wife and I are living proof that that can be healed in people, that all that can be restored. I have watched that be restored in people in my church where that's been restored. They come in and I can go through a few couples and that kind of thing. And, I can use the Montgomery. So much of that was hurt in the Montgomerys. I don't know to what extent, but it was hurt. It wasn't working right. After a while, they worked on some things. You began to see that to work right. You began to see that to happen again, that take back over, that natural part of them. There's nobody that God can't heal that with. Nobody. And that's why you have two different words here, and we've gone over it. That idea, there's celibate, virgin, and chaste. All three different things. They are not equal things. Celibate means you won't marry. Priests take a vow of celibacy, but not chastity. Okay? That's why, for example, the rate of AIDS is 4 times as great in Catholic priests as the population at large. All right? And huge problems with that whole community because of that vow of celibacy. So they say celibate, but they don't say chaste. And there's just huge, huge problems with it. Virginity, I think everybody understands what that is, but chastity is something different. Chastity is where you're a sexually pure person, and that doesn't mean you're refraining. A girl on her honeymoon can be a chaste woman, even though she's yielding herself every single night to a guy and loving them going through that. But what it means is that if you were to sit next to her in the diner, she's not going to laugh at your crude joke. Okay, She doesn't want to hear that. She doesn't want to talk about that. She's not going to dress sexy so that everybody looks at her and the swaying of her hips says she's chaste. And to be honest with you, a man that has a woman like that has a gem. I mean, he absolutely has something that he will never tire of. I mean, if she could, if she'll go ahead and drape that body and keep it hidden and keep it for him and keep it behind the veils and such, and that's why her dress should be a veil and such. One of the most lewd things I ever saw in my life, okay, was done in public in Columbia, South Carolina, where a dancing troupe, it was an outdoor carnival, and a dancing troupe put up a shade, like a window shade, and they shined a bright light behind it, and they had some people go behind it dancing, take all their clothes off. So through there, you can't see a thing except the shadow, but that shadow was so exquisitely perfect that it was obvious what everyone was made of on the other side of it. And completely voluptuous. And you say, well, she didn't show anything. Yes, she did. She showed everything. Well, how you dress does the same thing. Okay? How you dress, you can say, well, it's covered. Cheap thrill. All right? I used to tell Ruth Ann, we'd go into some Baptist churches, and, you'd sit there and watch the women in the front row, and I'd tell my wife, I said, I believe I can go buy their underwear for them. You know, I believe I could walk in and tell you exactly what shape your underwear is and exactly what the tag said even on it. And my wife, oh, shut up. But I'm just telling you, hey, you know, it's the whole thing. If it's not for sale, don't advertise it, you know. But it's just that whole idea of how you dress. And you can drape yourself, or you can make it clearly silhouetted so that everybody can see every bump, every shape on you and everything else. Which way do you want to dress? And it's up to you, okay? Now, the point is, a man is to love his wife, care for her and such. A woman's to be chaste, to love that man. And a man. Sammy Allen said something years ago, and I loved him for this. Sammy now is in his later 70s, and always on the move, always on the run. He's gone about 50 weeks out of the year. Mm-hmm. He comes home late Friday night, early Saturday morning, consistently, spends the weekend with his wife, and somewhere Monday afternoon kisses her goodbye, doesn't see her again till late Friday night, early Saturday, does that 50 weeks out of the year. One particular time, I'd been Sammy's driver for about a month, taking him places and such. He was in a series of meetings. And all of a sudden, he just turned to me and he said, I keep myself in good shape. He said, you know why I do that? Why? I do it for Jimmy Lou. That was his wife's name. That's real Southern. Jimmy Lou. I do it for Jimmy Lou's sake. I do it for her. I keep myself in good shape. When I come home, she's got a husband in good shape. And I loved him for that. You know, it's that idea that a lot of guys let it go, and big old pot belly, and they don't care or anything else. Well, she cares. Bothers her. You know, it's done for her sake. You know, be somebody for her. Take care of yourself for her. It's that whole idea again of, you know, all the fellas know it. You go down to pay your oil bill, go down to the store, buy something, go anywhere you go, go into social services. It doesn't matter. When you see those women, they're dressed right. They look nice. They smell nice. They talk to you sweet. You go home, and there's your wife in curlers and, you know, wearing some kind of a sweatpants or something of that sort. And what kind of competition is that? There's no competition whatsoever. And it's that whole idea of why you put the strut on for them. I kid my wife, and my wife is decent about how she dresses at home, but I'll always kid her. She said, I can't. Oh, somebody's at the door. I can't let them see me like this. Oh, yeah, you let me see you like that. You know? And I'll always kid her, give her a hard time. I can't go out looking like this. Oh, yeah, you look like that in front of me, you know, but you don't want to do it for the grocer, huh? But it's that old-fashioned idea. Have a little respect for that person you're married to. Have that respect for them and vow to yourself, I will always look my best for that person. I'm going to do everything I can for that person to look everything that I can for them. Now, goes on again, and it says this again, Verse 31, for this cause shall a man leave his father and mother, and the two shall be, and join unto his wife, and they two shall be one flesh. And again, that one flesh is a lot more than just a quick sex act. That one flesh is a union of even the way their brains think because of that physical union. That physical union is not what they teach you in textbooks. It is not just some quick little thing like, you know, getting a buzz with a beer one night or something like that. It has lasting, long-reaching consequences. And when it's handled right, it's the most wonderful thing that can happen. It's a marriage. It'll last a lifetime with deep devotion one to another. When it's handled wrong, it'll cause more misery and agony and sorrow than you can shake a stick at. Now, he says in verse 32, this is a great mystery, but I speak concerning Christ and the church. The idea, and here's one of the mysteries that Paul talks about, the mystery of the body of Christ. The idea that everybody gets saved is part of his body. Okay, part of it. Verse 33, nevertheless, let every one of you in particular so love his wife, even as himself. And then it says, and the wife see that she reverence her husband. Now I want to go to Psalm 111. Psalm 111. And I want to show you a verse that is a very abused verse. Psalm 111, look at verse 9. He sent redemption unto his people, and he hath commanded his covenant forever. Now look at this. Holy and reverend is his name. Now, is that saying that his name is a holy and reverend name?
That is his name.
Now, capital F, a capital R or not? Then it's not the name. Yeah. Right. And that's how you know. If it was his name, there's another place, and God whose name is holy, it's a capital H. Okay? And that's how, the only way you'd know that. Because you wouldn't get it from the context any other way. Okay? Holy and reverend is his name, meaning that his name is a reverend name. His name is a holy name. What time you looked at it, if you weren't paying attention to whether, let's say for example that the King James Bible was not perfect, okay? Like 99% of Baptists believe that it's not perfect. Then whether or not it had a capital R wouldn't mean anything, would it? See what I mean? But because it doesn't have a capital R, and we believe it's perfect, in fact, we know it's perfect, he's not saying that his name, oh, how you doing there, Reverend? You know, that's not his name. We're saying that if we had his name, it's a reverend name. Okay? That's what this verse is saying. But you'll hear commonly where a lot of preachers don't want to be called reverend because they think they're stealing God's name being called reverend. I have people come up and call me reverend, and I'm not exactly thrilled with me. I think it's some little panty waist, some little... said, how you doing, Reverend? You know, some little sissy somewhere being called Reverend. But it says, see, the woman reverence her husband. Okay? There's nothing wrong with revering a man. Okay? A man can be revered for many reasons. I only point that out because sooner or later you'll hear someone say, only God's name is Reverend. He's the only Reverend. Don't call me Reverend. You'll hear that. They're talking about Psalm 111, verse 9. And that is not what Psalm 111:9 says. You know, the Botens boys always called me Reverend. And I had to finally set them up. My name is John. It's not Reverend. But, you know, they grew up where that was the polite thing to say to the preacher of the Black Creek Baptist Church. They weren't doing that to be mean or anything else. That's what they grew up with. That was the term. All right. So back to Ephesians. So it says, to the woman, see that she reverence her husband. Now we get to 6. Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor thy father and mother. And then it says in parentheses, which is the first commandment with promise. Okay, when you read the Ten Commandments, it tells you don't do this, do this, don't do this. But what's it say about honor thy father and thy mother? That thy days on the earth might be long, which the Lord thy God giveth thee. So there's a commandment that's not just a commandment, but there's a promise made with it. That if you'll do this one, you'll live a longer life.
You won't get stoned back then.
Well, that's for sure. Yeah, that's, you could be stoned in the Old Testament for gross violations of honor thy father and thy mother. Okay, where, you know, my son is a glutton and a wine bibber, and they'd stone him to death. Okay, you take him up there, and that's all there was to it. Ideally, I mean, can someone who honor their father and their mother die young? Obviously they can, okay? But as a general rule, if you were to find people who live to long old age, and you were to find those who die early broken, I'll bet you'll find a much higher percentage in those who die early who just wouldn't honor their father and their mother, okay? You'll find a far higher percentage of those who lived a long life. And you're going to find exceptions on both sides for many different reasons, because it's not a perfect world, it's a sinful world. But you'll find a much higher percentage of them who lived that long life who honored their father and their mother. You know, one of the reasons, for example, that the Asian cultures do so well is they honor their father and their mother. New York City built some charter schools. And they did it vowing they would not pay attention to race. Instead, they were only going to allow the highest students in certain maths, English, different sciences and that, who scored the highest on these tests and did the best to be in those schools. And I saw the statistics. Generally, out of 1,000 students, 950 of them would be Asian. About 40 of them would be white, and about 10 would be black, with some Hispanics mingled in there. And I'm not exaggerating. And that's where they decided they weren't going to pay any attention whatsoever to race. They were just going to let people in based on their abilities. Does that mean Asians are smarter than Americans? No. What it means is that Asians have worked harder to keep this thing working. Honor thy father and thy mother and such. One of the most powerful things Brother Shankles did, you remember him taking Zane and setting him up there and saying, you want to see his school grades improve? He didn't know you guys from Adam's house, Cat. You want to see his school grades improve? He said, you let your home improve. You put that home together and you'll see all that starting to come together. And it's amazing how much better all that comes when the home becomes what it's supposed to be and how much easier it is for a child. You take a child and they're going through turmoil at home, and then you send them to school. They can't get anything out of that. I mean, it's, all they're doing is just fighting for survival all the time. They can't get out of that survival mode. When I was down there, one of the last times I went to the school, in fact, I think I went down there to help Debbie and Randy with something. We were in a conference or whatever, and the teachers were talking about a book that they highly recommended, but it was called Generational Poverty. And it was just trying to explain to teachers, you know, you have a kid and you're angry because he doesn't have a pencil. So you give him a pencil. Now, tomorrow I expect you to have a pencil. He comes in the next day, doesn't have the pencil, and you're furious with him. And what you don't realize is that his mother just moved in with another guy that had 5 kids, and he's sleeping on a trailer floor somewhere and trying to find anything to wear the next day and climb on a school bus with kids he's never seen before, and now you're mad at him. He doesn't have a pencil, see? And so they're trying to explain to these teachers, hey, these kids are coming out sometimes a living hell and coming into this school, and you don't have a clue to that, what this kid's actually going, what it took for him even just to get to sit in your classroom. You know, open your eyes. Try to understand what's going on there. And so these kids, they're going through every moment for them is survival. They're not coming home and, oh, you know, there's, June Cleaver and you know, a beaver, how was your day at school, and some brownies and milk, and, you know, and here's your couple little chores, and go out and play with the kids and come in, and dad comes in for some. They don't have that. They've never had that. They come home and it's an absolute war of survival. They learn to lie, they learn to cheat, they learn to carry on every which way and to make things work for themselves. And it's the only way they've ever known. And when they go to school, the idea that Mary Lou's sitting there learning her math tables means nothing. How do I survive in this atmosphere? How do I get by in this atmosphere? You can send him home with homework, and they might pay attention. One out of every 2 weeks, somebody will look and scream at you because the homework isn't done, but nobody paid attention the other, you know, all the other days of the week or anything else, and then they're mad at you because you don't have it done, and I thought we had this straight. And no, none of it's straight. It's just all a mess for them. And kids like that, their life is pure hell. Those kind of kids don't live long lives. They have no idea how to honor their father or mother or anything else. For one thing, they don't have honorable mothers and they don't have honorable fathers. Makes it hard to honor thy father and thy mother when you don't have honorable fathers and mothers. Makes it very hard to do. So, you take a culture like the Asians, where they have fought to keep that, their kids are just tearing the schools up. In fact, in California, one of the reasons they had, what do you call it there when you base people on race? I can't think of the...
equal opportunity?
It's not equal opportunity. It's affirmative action. Thank you, sir. I could not think of the word affirmative action. One of the reasons they did it is because the Asians were swamping the schools. It wasn't done to raise blacks up. It was done to hold Asians down. Okay? And, you know, the Asians were just absolutely swamping it. So, honor thy father and thy mother, which is the first commandment with promise. And you find cultures where they do that. Those cultures come out far better than the ones that don't. Verse 3, that it may be well with thee, and that thou mayest live long on the earth. And ye fathers, provoke not your children to wrath, but bring them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. The book of Proverbs is part of the nurture and admonition of the Lord. Fathers, provoke not your children to wrath. And you'd be amazed, you know, how many men you'll see there sit there and kind of pick on their kids and get them hot and get them carrying on and that kind of stuff. And they can never do anything right in their eyes or whatever. Don't do that. Okay? Don't provoke your children to wrath. You know, it's amazing, again, how many parents will do that. Poke at them and poke at them and poke at them like a bear in a cage or something because they can't hit back and get them all stirred up or whatever else. Terrible thing. Verse 5, servants, be obedient to them that are your masters according to the flesh, with fear and tremblingness and singleness of your heart is unto the Lord. Or excuse me, is unto Christ. I always remember the Sunday morning when I realized that Dale was going to make it at work. When Dale first went to work, I really wondered whether or not he'd make it. First job ever, 40 years old. And part of the reason is when you go to work, you're going to be treated unfair. Mm-hmm. Okay? Anybody ever here get treated fair all the time at work? Do you get treated fair all the time at work, Doug? No, not at all. If you couldn't take being treated unfair, could you have that job? No, you couldn't have it. Now, the problem is an abused person can't take being treated unfair. They'll scream, they'll carry on, they'll cry, they'll leave the job and such and tell everybody, but they promised this to me and Sally Sue got it. And every time she's late, they don't say anything, but I'm late and everybody comes at me and such. And it's all true. There's not a bit of that that's wrong. But it's all part of life. And if you heard it from Sally Sue's side, she might be getting it well there, but somewhere else it's not right for her. Okay? And it's just so part of real life is that you're constantly not treated fair. That's just part of real life, okay? And you just go on. But an abused person cannot, and that's why they can't keep jobs, because they cannot handle being treated unfair. And when you talk to them, it really is terrible. Yeah, that is, you're right, that was awful. But it's all part of life. So when Dale went in there, I said, Dale, your problem isn't going to be doing your work. Your problem is going to be when you're treated unfair. And I said, you might as well make up your mind right now. It's going to happen. Might as well make up your mind that 18-year-old kid, some shift leader somewhere, will treat you unfair. And it's not going to be right at all what he does. It's going to be hypocritical. You know, people will laugh at you when it happens and everything else. And if you can't take it, don't even take that job. Just don't even do it. Just don't even bother. Don't even start. But if you could stand there and you can take being treated unfair and you can handle being treated unfair and say to yourself, you know, whether I'm treated unfair or treated fair, the pay is the same at the end of the week. And sometimes even that's not so. Sometimes something will happen, somebody gets a few extra hours you should have had or something of that sort and drive you crazy. I mean, that's just all part of it. But I remember the Sunday morning, Dale came in here, and he said, "Pastor, I didn't get any sleep last night. I'm going to have a hard time sitting this service." "What happened, Dale?" He said, "Well, I was supposed to work 3 hours. I'm the substitute janitor. It's the job they gave him, 10 hours a week. He was supposed to work 3 hours last night, but the main janitor's on vacation. And I went in to do his chores, and a truck pulled in, and no one was there, so I had to help him unload the truck for 4 or 5 hours. And by that time, I was exhausted, so I just went and pencil whipped all my chores. Did you do this? Did you do that?" And he said, "I started to punch out." And he said, "The Lord hit me." "You didn't do that stuff you said you did." And he said, "I had to go back and scrub every toilet. I had to go back and scrub the freezers. I had to go back and scrub all that stuff. I had to go back and do every bit of that stuff." And he said, "I just got done about a half hour ago. And I realize he's going to make it." You know, there's not a single person that would have blamed him if he'd walked out of there and not done that stuff. In fact, everybody else got away with it. But by golly, it was God that made him go back. It was God. He just could not punch that clock with his God. And this is the thing Paul's talking about here. "Servants, be obedient to them that are your masters according to the flesh, with fear and trembleness and singleness of heart as unto Christ." Okay? Your boss might be the biggest jerk that ever walked. Anybody that's ever worked for me has had that problem. Okay? But you don't do it as unto that person. You do it as unto the Lord. You know, part of, and I tell this to people all the time. People know I've got a war going on with Radio Shack. And I mean, I have a war going on with them. And part of what goes on, I have people over me. For example, there's a woman over 19 stores who really, I just drive her crazy. But I have never, in my arguments with her superiors, I've always defended her. You know, they're always trying to act like, well, maybe it's her that's doing it or something. And I always tell them, no, she's following your directions. She's doing exactly what you tell her to do. I said, if I were grading her right now, I'd give her an A+ for doing what you say. But it's stupid. And that's, and you know, but I'll, you know, because I'm not going to work for her if I can't be loyal. I don't want anybody working for me and can't be loyal. If I can't be loyal to the Wellsville Radio Show, I'm not going to work for it. If I can't be loyal. If you can't be loyal to Giant, don't work for them. But I think, yeah, that's, you know, and it doesn't mean you think they're perfect or anything else or the greatest job, but if you can't be loyal to them, by golly, don't work there. Go get a job somewhere else. It pollutes you, it demeans you, it turns you into something awful. You know, when you get a workplace and you've got a person that's always griping, complaining, it tears the workplace to pieces. And they usually have valid points. You know, it's usually the right, okay? But who, you know, how would you like for me to take somebody and we'll stand them here and we'll all pick about what's wrong with that person? Is there anybody here that could survive that? Anybody here that wants to go through that? Okay? And we could go on for hours and never say the same thing twice about any one of us. Okay? Does that, anybody want to live that way? Well, don't do that with where you work. Don't do that with the people you work with. You know, and there's always going to be stuff. I can roll my eyes as quick as anybody there, and I can talk about stuff as any quick. But I'm going to do a good job, and when I leave, I'm going to do a good job, and I'm going to do the best job that I can, and I'm going to be loyal to the people I work for. Why? Because I'm going to do it as unto Christ. Then it says in verse 6, not with eye service. Everybody understand what that is? Just doing something because they're looking. They're looking so you do it. If they're not looking, you don't do it. Not with eye service. And that's always embarrassing. You know, I've been caught at that a couple of times, and it's shameful when it happens. You know, not doing anything, or some boss walks in, all of a sudden you look busy. Okay? And that's embarrassing. And I try to discipline myself. If I'm standing there watching some football game at Radio Shack, I don't care who walks out. I'm going to keep looking at it. I want to see this play. You know, and you know why? Because it's more shameful to jump up and run away. Like, oh, I wasn't looking at that football game. Oh no, you know where? You know, you're just standing over there gazing at it when I walked in the door. They walk in, I'll say, "Hey, they're about to score a touchdown. I wanted to see it," and they can get mad at that, but I don't want to be hypocritical about it. And I always want to have stats that back up what I'm saying or doing. So, not with eye service as men pleasers. It's learning to be what you are. And back to this thing again, and I drill my children on this. You are what you are in secret. Okay? I only have two kids on their own right now, Audie and Eric. But whatever they are in secret, it's what they'll become when suddenly they move out of their parents' house. Okay? You know, who hasn't seen, you know, your older sisters? Then they just become what they were the second they moved out. What they secretly were, they just became. Okay? And you'll do the same thing. Whatever you secretly are at home, bam, that's what you are. And the thing is, adults then learn a secret life. And, I mean, there's certain things that obviously no one needs to know, certain little things about my life or whatever. There's that TMI thing, too much information, and you know, it's more pleasant not to know certain things about certain people. But at the same time, I don't want to have some life where secretly I'm looking at porn or secretly I'm, you know, reading books that, you know, you'd be aghast that I was reading those kind of things. And I listen to a lot of audiobooks. I spend a lot of time in a car. I listen to a lot of audiobooks. And every once in a while, one will come on where there's something a little bit racy said in that book. And, you know, and I'll fast forward through that. But if it happens again, that's it. Boom. It's gone. You know why? And it's not that I couldn't fast forward to the next one. I just don't want my children picking up, "Well, Dad was listening to this." You know? That's okay. Dad was listening to this. And I don't want that. I don't want to have that kind of thing. I don't want it where I'm just kind of eye service and this is what I am in secret. But, you know, out public, this is what I am. Your kids will catch on to that in a heartbeat. Dr. James Dobson said this, and I agree with him. He said there is no single more devastating thing for a young man than to find his father's pornography stash. He said, you want to destroy a young man, let him see Dad's pornography stash. Okay? And if you have one, they find it. Don't think they did it, okay? They found it. And absolutely destructive. Absolutely no excuse, no purpose for it whatsoever. And God pity the poor woman that gets a guy that looks at pornography. God pity that poor woman. God pity her, okay? It goes on and says this, not with eye service, verse 6, as men pleasers, but as the servants of Christ, doing the will of God from the heart. And you know, am I perfect in that? No. Is anybody perfect in that? No. But we admire the people who labor at it and work at it and try to be consistent in what they are and really try it. You know, it's just, it's the right way to be. Verse 7, with goodwill, doing service as to the Lord and not to men. Or you're just out there doing this stuff, saying, hey, the Lord's watching me. I don't care what men say. He's seeing this thing. Every once in a while, what you do is going to be misinterpreted and mad. And I got a phone call from somebody tonight about something I preached last night. Oh, I heard you said this, this, and this. Okay? And I said, well, we have this discussion. As far as I know, Carrie records every single thing I ever preach. I said, if you need, we can mail it to you, you know, and send it to you. But it's just this whole idea that you're going to have things that get misunderstood and people mad, and that's always going to happen. You're never going to have a time where everybody sees it wonderful all the time what you're doing, okay? But if you try to do things as unto the Lord and do it right, in the long run, people catch on. Okay, even on the short run, from time to time, it doesn't go right. By the way, there is never any more offended person than a person who is a habitual liar, who one of the few times they tell the truth is accused of lying. Okay, you think you're telling they're a habitual liar. Did you clean your room? I don't think you did. And this is the one time in a million they ever did it. And you walk in there and see, and you didn't believe me and all that kind of. Usually when you have somebody like that, you're dealing with a terrible liar. A terrible, terrible liar. What's that?
I just went through that.
That's right, yeah. If you have somebody that's a habitual liar, and they told the truth one of those few times, you know, that they did it, and such, and you accuse him of lying that time, it's like, Katie, bar the door, okay? You know, that, think of Ed Money. You know, you catch him one time telling the truth on something, and, you know, and it's, and they didn't believe it. You come here and you look, you ask, and calling people, you listen to them and such. Hey, be cool, you know? And it's always a tip off that you're dealing with a liar when you have somebody that goes to bat and cradle to prove they were telling the truth. You accuse me of lying on something, hey. You know, I feel bad. Hopefully I wasn't. Hopefully I, you know, I've lied before. Sometimes not even meaning to. You just get some exaggerating, get a little mixed up or whatever else. Okay, hey. But if you get somebody who goes to great lengths and calling everybody and proving it no matter what, you usually got a pretty bad liar there. Then it goes on, it says, verse 8, knowing that whatsoever good thing any man doeth, the same shall he receive of the Lord, whether he be bond or free. And this is the whole point. You're counting on God to reward you. You're counting on God to take care of you. You're counting on God to come in and defend you. You're counting on God to have that relationship with him. And if you have that, it doesn't matter what men think. Verse 9, and ye masters do the same things unto them, forbearing, threatening. Yeah. You know, and knowing that whatsoever good thing any man doeth, the same shall he receive of the Lord, whether he be bond or free. Okay, so it's God that will reward you. But you masters, you know who the biggest masters in this room are? You mothers with children. Okay, and ye masters do the same things unto them, forbearing, threatening. Really, if you're threatening, something's going wrong. In other words, children ought to know what the rules are. They ought to understand them. If there's any confusion where they don't understand the rule, go over it again. You know, make sure it's understood. And for me, anytime I ever explain the new rule, I've always assumed they're going to break it the second I'm turned around, so I'd always set them up to break it. Okay? Now, I don't want you guys going to this room and no one's to touch that whatsoever else. And, you know, you step in the other room and act like you're making noise and count, and 20 seconds later walk in and they're all in that room. And you just count on it. You just assure they're going to do it and such. And then you go in there, you beat tail. You don't explain, I told you not to go in there. You don't have to say a word. You just grab their hand. Ah! They knew they were there. Why all the threatening and yelling? Consistence. It's one of the things I talk about. Poor Jody. And then she's laboring at it. But you know, she talks about how with Trevor, when they have church practice, he can do it on his head. She can sit him down, and he'll sit there. He can sit an hour, just perfect in church practice. But the reason is because there's a one-on-one ratio. When he screws up, it's an immediate punishment. He knows that. Why would he screw up? You know why people play Russian roulette? Because 5 out of 6 times you can get away with it. Okay? You know why kids will be naughty? Because 5 out of 6 times they can get away with it. And then finally you'll shrug and grab them and go to spank them. And it's almost unfair. Because they've gotten away with it for so long. You're the one that taught them that it's a Russian roulette game. And so the thing is, you've got to have a 1-to-1 ratio with punishment. 1-to-1 ratio. You did it, here's the judgment. You did it, this is what happens. And it can't be screaming, it can't be yelling, it can't be any of that kind. The calmer you are, the more effective it is. You walk in, you know, and they actually tremble when you just calm, have it together, walk in there, call, oh, they know what it was. You walk in there, wail that little tail. We were watching Art Linkletter the other day. We got this thing, Kids Say the Darndest Things. You older people remember that.
Yeah.
You know, he'd take them in and he'd interview little kids. And, you know, they'd be 7 or 8 years old. Well, any secrets your parents told you not to tell? Yeah? Well, what's that? I don't understand it. What do you mean? Well, they said, don't tell the family secret. Well, what is the family secret? I don't know, but mom's getting fatter. And, you know, and it just, he'd bring out this innocent thing in children. Now, today you couldn't do it because kids aren't innocent like that. I can't imagine the awful things that would be said. But he asked those kids in the 1960s, sitting on television, Who would you rather have spanked, your mama or your daddy?
Daddy.
Well, here's the thing. Well, some said mama, some said daddy, or this and that. But the amazing thing is all of them got spanked.
Yeah.
Oh, I know.
And all of them discussed it openly on television, and everybody oohed and aahed, and it was cute. It was just expected.
Yep.
There wasn't a single, it wasn't like, what, sickos, and, you know, CPS called, and all this kind of stuff. It was just understood that every one of those kids got spanked at home. One would say, well, my daddy uses a belt, so I prefer my mama because she uses my hand. And they're openly discussing that on television. And, you know, and these are well-adjusted, nice little kids. There's not a single thing wrong with them, one bit whatsoever, or anything else. And, you know,
just so. I was actually watching a movie today. It's a modern movie. And it was spank was actually used in the movie. And I was actually surprised that the little boy was referring to his sister getting spanked. And I was shocked because you just don't hear it.
No, you don't hear it. Yeah. All right. Alright, so he goes on and he says, verse 9 again. And ye masters, do the same things unto them, forbearing threatening, knowing that your master also is in heaven, neither is the respect of persons with him. Okay? Not going to respect one person over another. Then he's now, verse 10, finally, my brethren, be strong in the Lord and in the power of his might. So, I'm going to wait to get into the armor of God. We'll get into that. We're almost getting where we can go. We'll get into the armor of God next week and tear that apart more fully. But it's the whole idea. You're going to find this is the very armor that Jesus Christ wore on earth. Okay? And it's the armor of God. So we'll get into that next week. In fact, John, you're up. Why don't you close us in prayer? Yeah.
Our Heavenly Father, Lord, we thank you for Pastor and his willingness to be used of you, Father, and bringing us your word. And we just ask, Lord, that it'll sink into our hearts, Lord, and we'll ponder the comments made and your holy word, Father. And we ask now for a blessing on the rest of the evening and safe travel home. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.